Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. It's The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and hey, snap out of it. I think you're having a bad dream. Some kind of ugly memory from the past? Let's try to reach in and give your bad memories a happy ending. Later this hour, how brain scientists are figuring out ways to put a positive spin on painful memories as a way of helping people overcome trauma and the effects of combat stress. Question, though, does making a rosy story out of painful experiences mess with our morality? Hey, somebody's memory of a car accident while they were drunk driving suddenly produces a smile? Uh-oh, do we really want that? There's a conversation. You can join it at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. But we begin with a look tactically on how the U.S. might proceed in Iraq from a military mind that has fresh memories of what went wrong in Iraq and Afghanistan. General David Barno was the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan from 2003 to 2005. He's now a senior fellow and co-director of the Responsible Defense Program at the Center for a New American Security. He says because of our recent experience in the region, it will be a challenge to keep U.S. involvement and confrontation with ISIS from becoming an all-out military operation.
What we've seen so far, frankly, I come from a career in the United States Army. What we're seeing so far is that the fact that ISIS is so powerful on the ground, they don't have an Air Force, they don't have a Navy, but they've got an incredibly capable military force on the ground that's, to our great surprise, pushed back the Kurdish Peshmerga. They pushed back the Iraqi security forces and decimated a number of their units. They've had a lot of success against Assad's forces in Syria. They're very capable as a land army. And that's very worrisome because we are not in a position where we want to commit boots on the ground to repel them. But there's going to have to be some force on the ground, in my judgment, to push them back out of these areas that they've taken over. It's not going to work by simply applying bombs and drones to the problem set.
Osama bin Laden sends planes into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and it took months and then years, if you include Iraq, to mobilize against al-Qaeda. We're already there now.
Well, I think this foreign fighter issue with ISIS is very worrisome, and I know the intelligence agencies have been talking about that for months. It's only now started to get out in the public square and has gotten some traction. But there are, by many estimates, as many as 3,000 foreign fighters that have come mostly out of Europe, but some from the United States, and joined ISIS in Syria and now potentially in Iraq. The worry about them is not what they're going to do in Syria and Iraq, but the worry is that they'll take those passports and come home to Western Europe or to the United States and begin a follow-on campaign there that's a terror campaign against, you know, our values and our national security among our allies in Western Europe as well as here at home. So I think that's extremely worrisome. I think Europe has a much bigger problem there, simply in numbers alone, than the United States has. But all the intelligence agencies are watching this very carefully.
Are we ready for that? I mean, this fellow that they found who came from the United States who was killed in the fighting with al-Nusra, are we ready for these folks coming home for Thanksgiving?
I think that's a very high bar challenge for our border security, for the Department of Homeland Security, our controls on passengers coming on airline flights. That's going to be very difficult. Again, our problem is probably considerably more defined and smaller than that of the European nations. There's overland transit routes to Europe coming through Turkey, and there's a problem right now with jihadis that are actually passing through Turkish loose border controls and getting into Eastern Europe. Those could easily show up in the capitals in London or Paris here in a month or two, and I think that's very worrisome to the European governments. They have a much more difficult problem set than we do, but ours is tough enough.
Does the Pentagon have a view on what might happen if ISIS attempts a terrorist attack either in Europe or the United States, in the sense that is the Pentagon more likely to say, look, we don't want to get into a tit-for-tat response situation on the ground in a place like Iraq if there's an attack in the United States? We want to be more strategic. Or are they inclined to say, hey, we're here, whatever you want, we'll deliver?
Well, I think what the role of the U.S. military is here is to provide the president with a broad range of different options that go from doing what we're doing now or less all the way to, major combat operations in the region. And the president needs to know what he can do if something that horrific were to happen. So I'm sure there's contingency planning going on to think about how the U.S. would employ much greater levels of force than we're doing today. But clearly, after the last 13 years of prolonged wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, nobody in the military is pushing for that option. But if it comes to the point where the United States is attacked again, I think all bets are off.
Is there a preventive strategy before we go here in dealing with ISIS, in the sense that we do have the opportunity here to do something that would prevent the kind of 2001 scenario that we've already experienced and already produced the problems that make the Pentagon pause in going back into war? What's the preventive strategy as you see it?
I don't think it's that clear-cut, unfortunately. I've seen a lot of discussion about whether we should take a targeted attack against the leadership of ISIS to try and knock out the chiefs in the organization before they can mobilize to do more attacks outside of the Middle East. I'm not sure that would be effective, and I think in some ways it might even be counterproductive. So I think we have to be a little bit more cautious and deliberate on how we contain the ISIS threat. ISIS and al-Qaeda are different, and not only in terms of how radical ISIS is, which is more than al-Qaeda, but ISIS is holding territory. They have ground forces and mobilized, you know, military capability there that we can actually see. They're trying to put governance in place in a number of these locations. They're not going to be a shadowy organization that hides out in some other nation's cities in the Middle East. They're going to actually own a nation state of some sort that they're trying to create. So I think we're going to have to look at this a little bit differently. And I'm not convinced in my own mind right now that targeted attacks against their leadership are really going to buy us the kind of protection that we hope.
General David Barno, top U.S. commander in Afghanistan from 2003 to 2005, now a senior fellow and co-director of the Responsible Defense Program at the Center for New American Security. Thanks so much, General.
Thanks, John.
So al-Qaeda expelled ISIS earlier this year for being too radical, a signal that the U.S., Syria, and the world were dealing with something fundamentally different. As the general points out, compared to the loose bargain basement remote control al-Qaeda run from caves in Pakistan, communicating by hand messages delivered by couriers on donkeys, ISIS is into governance, is flush with cash, and operates openly. William McCants helped formulate policy on dealing with al-Qaeda when he was a State Department advisor. He's now director of the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World at the Brookings Institution. William McCants, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So what's keeping ISIS afloat aside from, you know, their well-produced videos? Where are they getting the money, for instance?
ISIS gets a lot of its money from kidnappings, from the towns that they control. They charge taxes and extort local businessmen. They get a lot of money from oil wells that they control in eastern Syria. Not much of the money comes from abroad, surprisingly. Most of the money they're able to generate themselves, which makes them a particularly strong threat. If a lot of their money came from abroad, you could do more to tighten up regulations and crack down on those people sending money. The fact that they're able to generate their money on their own means that it's going to be more difficult to cut off their sources of funding.
So compared to the Wizard of Oz, Osama bin Laden behind the curtain sort of smoke and mirrors, ISIS is a self-sustaining entity, almost like a corporation.
That's right. Both of them function like corporations, but ISIS much more so because it controls territory and they're more out in the open than al-Qaeda ever was. Al-Qaeda was a classic clandestine terrorist organization. ISIS is an insurgent group and almost bordering on a formal military organization. They are very sophisticated and they're doing a lot more than trying to just take territory. They're trying to govern it.
And we'll talk about the governance in a moment, but if they have oil wells that they fully own and they're not getting money from overseas, there's really no way to squeeze off the financial connections, right? Unless you actually go into Syria and take back the oil wells, for instance.
That's right. There's no easy way to do this. You can't do it just with air power alone. You're going to need to have some sort of force on the ground that is going to be able to take this territory back from ISIS. That doesn't mean deploying U.S. troops, but you need to have a capable proxy to operate through. And so far, the U.S. doesn't have one in Syria.
But somebody's brokering that oil and tossing it into the, you know, global pool. Is there a way to attack them?
Well, they're not tossing it back into the global pool. The ISIS militants are actually selling it back to the Syrian military. Or they could even be selling it sometimes to other insurgent groups or to just locals who need the material. So they're not tied into the global market, and they're getting poor rates for the oil. But nonetheless, for a small insurgent organization like theirs, the money is plenty.
That's interesting. They're getting poor rates. They're selling bottom dollar because they need the money and the cash, and they're not interested in making profits. So that really is disruptive to the market on a small scale, and on a larger scale could be really, really disruptive if they get, for instance, access to oil wells in Libya, right?
That's true. And they also, because they have a large military and have pushed into Iraq, they border countries that do control serious oil installations, such as Saudi Arabia. Now, ISIS doesn't have the capability to defeat the Saudi army, which is armed to the teeth with very effective U.S. military technology. But even if ISIS just pushed in there, launched a raid of some sort, sending in 100 vehicles, it would really scare the global oil markets.
That is interesting. All right, let's end on the governance question. It's a curious form of governance to go into villages and behead people. I mean, as a hearts and minds mission, ISIS has some work to do if they're going to really get a constituency on the ground.
That's right. And that's been the big head scratcher for outside observers. This goes back to the tension between al-Qaeda in Iraq and al-Qaeda Central, run by bin Laden and now Zawahiri. Back in the 2000s, Ayman Zawahiri, who was the deputy of al-Qaeda, asked Zarqawi, who ran al-Qaeda in Iraq at the time, to chill with the beheadings, explaining that while technically they were legitimate in terms of public relations, they were a disaster. He also chided Zarqawi for not working more closely with non-jihadis in order to shore up popular support for al-Qaeda's mission. Zarqawi ignored his advice, and his descendants, his heirs in the organization, are following Zarqawi's line. They are very brutal when they take over a town. They're not following classic insurgent techniques of trying to win over hearts and minds. And as a result, they often end up alienating the people they seek to dominate.
But if they succeed on this governance question going forward, they could end up back in the al-Qaeda sort of umbrella, and they could sort of realign with al-Qaeda, which would have other sort of strategic implications for the United States.
That's true, but it's difficult to see that happening because there was such a sharp break between the organizations. ISIS was not kicked out primarily because it was more radical than al-Qaeda. It was kicked out because it disobeyed Zawahiri's direct order publicly, and that kind of insubordination couldn't be tolerated, and he will look very weak if he allows them back in the organization.
William McCants, former State Department advisor on violent extremism, now director of the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World at the Brookings Institution. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
One of the consequences of the U.S. fight against al-Qaeda and terrorism is the bolstering of local police forces here in the United States with paramilitary equipment and actual combat gear, such as large-caliber machine guns, armored cars, and aircraft. Can they handle this capability? 184 police departments have been cut off from the Pentagon pipeline because they have simply lost M14, M15, and M16 rifles and 45-caliber pistols. And there are fears that some of this equipment could end up on the black market. Joining us is Daniel Rivero, producer at the Fusion Network. Welcome.
Thanks, John.
So how are you tracking these weapons? And, you know, what's the sanction for these local police departments?
So I've actually unraveled a list that the Pentagon provided me of departments that have been suspended from this program. The problem is that the Pentagon hasn't provided me with any information about why these departments were suspended. Basically, it's a matter of doing a lot of legwork and making a lot of calls to every different state and in many cases to some police departments directly to try to figure out what the reason for suspension is. And as I suspected, in many cases, it's because of missing weapons.
And is anyone tracking these weapons besides you and your teams?
It doesn't seem like it. I mean, the Pentagon was unable to get me any details about the departments that have already been suspended. They told me it would take weeks to gather that information. So I suspect that they have it somewhere in their database, but it's just going to take them a long time to collect, which raises some red flags because it suggests that they don't actually have a database readily available of these weapons that have gone missing in the departments where it happened.
In terms of South Florida, what's the worst case scenario of where these weapons might end up?
In Florida, there was a list of 7 departments that were listed as suspended. And I talked to someone that works close with the state coordinator, and he basically told me that there was weapons that went missing, and then they were all located, so they're all in good standing with the program right now. What we seem to have happening is that every time they do an inventory, a lot of departments find that they have weapons missing. In many cases, they do find the weapons, and in some cases, I've seen that an officer might take it home and then bring it back. But in many cases, I mean, they just have open investigations and criminal reports written about these guns.
So at the very least, what you've got here is a profile of some really lax security and lax sort of controls over a really, fundamentally, beyond the normal police capability of weaponry here. I mean, M14s, M15s, and M16s are fully automatic weapons in the military configuration, right?
Yeah, it brings up an interesting question about, many of these police departments that are receiving this are really small. I mean, we're talking about towns that have a couple hundred people in them. And there's a valid question about how capable are they to manage this inventory and how much oversight at the local level do these weapons have?
What's the, most kind of Mayberry, example here where a small police department was really set up to be a kind of a, paramilitary militia?
Well, I mean, I have a couple of examples of just strange stories, like the Georgia Department of Corrections. They sold a military-owned Humvee, and then according to the reports that I had, they had to go fetch it back from the person they sold it to and then give it to the state, who then gave it to another law enforcement agency within the state. And in Mississippi, I have a case of a small police department where one of these guns was taken to a gun exchange in exchange for a Glock. And then now they have, according to the reports, no way to track where that gun actually went after it was exchanged for another gun.
How did you get tipped off to this story?
Interesting enough, on the way to work here in Miami, I was passing down this major avenue next to our airport, and I look to my right, and there's an armored vehicle sitting right off the sidewalk, and I'm stuck in traffic, and it's kind of hovering over me. And I thought to myself, what is this armored vehicle doing? It just made me kind of uncomfortable. So I got to work that day, and I started actually making some calls. I talked to the chief, and he told me, oh, we got it through this government program, but actually it was just at the shop getting repairs. And I checked, and that was right. But it kind of set me off in this path of, trying to follow who regulates these things that the federal government is getting, and who's keeping track of it, and the use and the inventory, et cetera.
Now, do law enforcement officials that you spoke with, and again, you're just at the beginning of this investigation, do they think they need, Humvees and armored vehicles? And in the case of the Georgia Corrections, I mean, I guess they sold it, so maybe they don't need it. But do these folks want to hold on to this stuff?
There's a sense that some departments see it as free fodder that they can kind of grow into. So if you have the capability to get equipment that doesn't come out of your budget, then you might be able to more rapidly expand your operation without having to pay for the equipment that goes alongside it. I haven't been able to find any cases of misuse of any weapons or any armored vehicles of any kind. But, I mean, it just seems like if you put things up for grabs, people are likely to grab it. And then if there's not a system in place to track how these things are being used, a lot of it's just left up in the air.
And anecdotally, it sounds like, some of the things that you're watching indicate that cops, would rather trade some of this stuff than actually use it. They'd rather have a Glock than a 45 cal pistol or something like that. So there's an understanding within the police that they're getting it free, but they'd kind of rather have the cash to get stuff that they really need, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's important to keep in mind that a lot of this gear that they're getting is deemed as surplus by the military, which means that a lot of it is old and it's not necessarily in use. And some of it is actually old enough coming from the Vietnam era that, it might even be collectible and it might actually be very, very valuable on the open market. So some suspect that if you're selling an M14, that could potentially go for thousands of dollars on the open market. And, some officers might have done that.
Daniel Rivero is producer at the Fusion Network. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, John.
So the debate over abortion that has gone on for decades in the U.S. contains an assumption that is rarely questioned. Legal abortion generally happens with a doctor present, and so regulating abortion involves dictating to doctors when an abortion is legal, where a clinic can be built, whether abortion doctors can get insurance, forcing abortion doctors to affiliate with a hospital. Adding to these restrictions is the September 1st regulation taking effect in Texas that will mean about 1 million women will suddenly have to drive on average 150 miles to get an abortion if they need one. Globally, nearly 40% of the world's population lives in places where such medical restrictions or all-out bans on the medical procedure make abortions nearly impossible to get. Rebecca Gompertz is a physician and activist who is distributing a combination of abortion drugs that women can administer themselves without a doctor. Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon spent some time with Gompertz for a reporting piece out this week in the New York Times Magazine on how this doctorless approach may disrupt the entire abortion debate worldwide. Emily, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what's Gompertz like? She's a different kind of activist, wouldn't you say?
Yes, she is a radical, I would say. She thinks of herself as a human rights activist, and she's very focused on the suffering and hardship for women when they live in places where it's impossible or nearly impossible to access abortion. There are still about 47,000 women a year who are dying because of unsafe abortions, according to the World Health Organization, and that is her cause.
And she's had an impact. She's really turned the tables in some nations. Explain.
Well, she's based in Amsterdam, and she's running what she calls a telemedicine service, where women all over the world who live in countries where abortion is illegal or very restricted can write in to the help desk of her organization and get connected with a doctor who will write a prescription. And that prescription is filled by a drug exporter in India that is providing medication that Rebecca Gompertz knows is of high quality. And then from India, this medication, which causes abortion in the first trimester, is being shipped to women all over the world.
And this transaction is really out of the reach of most of the oversight institutions that try to restrict abortions. I suspect importing medicine without a license is illegal, but again, that's hard to enforce.
And it depends on the country. In some countries, yes, you're right. In other countries, not so clear. And Gompertz says that she has done the legal research to make sure that her organization, based in the Netherlands with doctors elsewhere, is operating legally.
What's her backstory? How did she come to this? What's her background as a physician?
Well, she worked as a ship's doctor for Greenpeace in the 90s after she went to medical school. And going around the world as a Greenpeace activist, I think, both showed her the power of direct action. And she also encountered families where mothers had died because of back alley abortions. And that really galvanized her.
And is she attracting a following, or is she sort of a lone wolf here?
In what she's doing, she's a lone wolf. No one else is providing this kind of service. Women all over the world are ordering abortion pills online, but often they can have no assurance that, you know, the pills are of good quality, that they're not fakes. And so that's the crucial link she's providing here. And what she's doing is pretty radical, particularly from the point of view of the American pro-choice movement, where the mantra is that, you know, an abortion is between a woman and her doctor, and it's very based in physical clinics. So this idea of telemedicine is still pretty unusual in the United States.
We're talking about doctorless procedures for abortion and the doctor who's providing that service. And it's a new radical approach that threatens to disrupt the entire abortion debate around the world. We're talking about that with Emily Bazelon from Slate. How do these drugs work exactly, Emily?
They both cause women to expel a fetus, and they also cause the termination of the fetus. And the increasingly research shows that they're both very effective. They're up to 98% effective in the first trimester, and also that they're safe relative to other kinds of procedures and relative to giving birth.
And one of the ironies here is that the pro-choice movement wants to create a kind of less traumatic situation for people who need abortions by, you know, offering counseling and that sort of thing. At least that's the argument on the face. I suspect by creating a set of restrictions that push women into this drug-induced abortion, I mean, that could produce a lot of trauma on people sort of by themselves expelling a fetus in the first trimester. What are the downsides here?
Well, you know, it really depends on women and how they experience a miscarriage, because that's what this is. It's an induced miscarriage. And so, you know, for all of time, women have been naturally miscarrying by themselves. If it's really early in the pregnancy, sometimes it isn't physically particularly difficult. Other times it can be painful and take place over hours and be a hard thing to go through. What this organization does is provide a lot of information to women about what they're experiencing so they know what they're going through.
How does the organization and how does Dr. Gompertz deal with someone who's trying to get this done much later in the pregnancy?
They don't serve women after the first trimester. In fact, if women get in touch with them and they're more than 9 weeks pregnant, the organization says, we're sorry, but we can't help you because we need time to mail you this medication and we want to make sure you get it within the first 12 weeks.
Now, that sounds nice. Of course, you know, the person could be lying on the phone, right?
That's true. There is always a risk of that. The drugs do work in the second trimester in terms of ending a pregnancy. The problem is, as you were referring to earlier, the risk goes up and also what it's like to actually deal with the experience becomes more difficult for a lot of women. And so at that point, having a doctor's supervision is much more recommended.
Certainly politically, this workaround, I would think, would draw, you know, the predictable supporters in the pro-abortion movement or a pro-choice movement and the predictable critics in the so-called pro-life movement. But what do public health physicians say about the proliferation of these drugs around the world in the course of your reporting?
You know, this was the thing that surprised me the most in reporting, because I found that every expert I talked to who knows this subject was very much in favor of disseminating good quality drugs with the right information. And the reason has to do with what public health officials call harm reduction. If you live in a country where abortion is illegal, you're not going to be less likely to have an abortion. You know, for example, in Brazil, where women are prosecuted, there's still 1 million abortions happening every year, and 200,000 women a year are suffering serious complications. So public health officials look at that and there's a clear cost-benefit analysis. And so they say women who are going to end their pregnancies are much better off taking this relatively safe medication than going through a traditional back alley abortion, which really is dangerous.
Did public health officials who spoke to you, you know, prefer that the abortion debate sort of go away, be rendered moot by these drugs, that in a sense the debate itself puts women in harm's way because it keeps women from doing things that they were going to do anyway in a safe way?
That's a really interesting question. You know, it's impossible to take the politics out of abortion, especially in this country. It's kind of unimaginable. So I think it's, yes, if you were thinking about this clearly in straight up public health terms, women would be able to make choices that were simply based on what is best for their safety. But that's just not the world we live in.
Well, interesting. You know, it's a technological change that's going to transform politics depending on how this proliferates. And we'll see if the situation in places like Bangladesh and Portugal is replicated in places like Texas, where restrictions go into effect as early as this weekend. Emily, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Emily Bazelon, senior editor for Slate. Her article on Rebecca Gompertz, the doctor we spoke about, is in this week's New York Times Magazine. In the 1990 movie Jacob's Ladder, actor Tim Robbins was tortured by visions, memories, and flashbacks.
Where are you taking me? Where am I?
Where do you want to go?
Home.
This is your home. You're dead.
I'm not dead.
What are you then?
I'm alive.
The movie does not have a happy ending. And if it did, it would not have been much of a movie. All our fearful memories where the demons live are a rich source for ghost stories and horror flicks. If we could turn our brain into a whiteboard, though, and just rewrite our ugly memories to make them all sunny days, it might take the edge off Halloween. It could also help some people struggling with the past, like this person in Covina, California. My father, who's my best friend and my soul twin, bought me my first guitar, and he was instrumental in my singing and playing the guitar. But one evening, someone very close to my heart destroyed that guitar in the heat of an argument. That was in 2008, and I haven't picked up the guitar since. It hurt me so much that someone so close to me could destroy something that meant so much. Picking up my other guitars just reminds me of that night. I wish I could erase that memory. A listener from California. Researchers at MIT say they've figured out how to shift positive associations onto negative memories, though, by turning on and off some key neurons in mice. Do we really want to do that? David Moorman is an assistant professor of psychological and brain sciences at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. David, welcome.
Hi, Don. Nice to talk to you today.
So that's kind of a scary capability. Looks positive at first glance, but then if you think about it, first of all, what have they done over there at MIT?
Well, so basically what they've done is they've figured out a way of, as you described, taking memories and manipulating the neural circuits that are underlying those memories. So in the example that you gave, you could take that memory about the listener's guitar and perhaps try and remove some of the negative aspects of the smashing the guitar from that memory and hopefully get that person back to the point that they can actually be able to have some positive associations with that guitar again.
How would something like this be accomplished? Would you take a pill? Would it involve surgery? I mean, it's too early to tell, obviously, but what kind of therapies would have this as a result?
Sure. So the kind of research that's actually being done now is still in preclinical phases. And so in these studies, they used mice as subjects, and they required intracranial surgery. So they actually had to put in a viral vector into their brain and use an optic fiber to use lasers, which is a pretty cutting-edge neuroscience technique. But obviously, it's not something that we'd want to try in the clinic quite yet. But there's a pretty quick jump that could be made where we might be able to think of non-invasive techniques that might be able to do this. So as you mentioned, we could come up with a pill that might be able to target these specific neural circuits and maybe use that as a way of non-invasively triggering them, or perhaps using some sort of a magnetic pulse that might go on from the outside that could actually be involved in manipulating some of these brain circuits.
So just one quick question on that. Do we have any therapy that turns off very selective neurons without erasing a memory or doing something, you know, more broadly to the brain, you know, putting you to sleep, making you drowsy, that kind of thing?
Sure. There's not a whole lot of options for that right now. Right now, most of our treatments are limited to things like pharmacology or psychotherapy, or in extreme cases, putting something like a stimulating electrode in the brain. So, for example, in the case of Parkinson's disease patients or treatment-resistant depression. But none of these solutions are very selective. And that's one of the real benefits of the research that's being done, that we're actually being able to really selectively target these networks that are associated with memories and emotions. And that, I think, is what's going to give us the power to solve these problems in the future.
All right. We want selective. But what if in the story about the guitar, instead of somebody who wants to be able to pick up the guitar, it's actually somebody who spent a lot of time, you know, torturing people in a prison, and they want to forget all the bad memories there. And now when they think of torture, or maybe they were a drunk driver or something and have a lot of guilt associated with that memory, they go through some therapy to make it feel like, okay, well, that wasn't so bad. Morally speaking, that's kind of dicey.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. I mean, whenever we talk about issues like manipulating brain circuits or manipulating memories or emotions, there's definitely going to be a host of ethical questions that we have to come up with to address it. I think, fortunately, right now, we're not at that state. We're still trying to figure out, basically, we're using these tools to figure out how the brain works. And I think that as it stands now, the possibility of treatment for some of these diseases is definitely worth pursuing the questions. Now, if it actually gets to the point that these could be implemented in the clinic, and probably even before that point, we definitely need to sort of bring in the bioethicists and the philosophers to come in and actually make some creative solutions for these problems. But I do think that there's no reason that we should sort of impede the progress of research just based on those concerns.
No. And I don't want to bring in a lot of annoying ethicists at this stage, but I am interested to know, in brain science, do scientists like yourself view a bad memory as something of a defense mechanism that alerts the organism to, you know, stay away from that experience? Or is it viewed more as a breakdown that causes dysfunction with the pain that results from that memory?
I think it's a really good distinction to make. I mean, I think that there's definitely evolutionary and survival related benefits to bad things happening. Exactly as you describe, if something bad happens, you probably want to avoid that in the future. And so in that case, it's actually a very adaptive mechanism. But you can imagine that there are some circumstances like post-traumatic stress disorder or depression where that system kind of goes out of control. And that's the situation that we really want to be able to target with some of these new technologies. So not so much, you know, erasing memories to make people feel good all the time, but to take people who maybe have gotten a little bit too far into some psychiatric trouble and bring them back so that they're feeling better.
So the better medical analogy is the immune system. We love the immune system. We want it there. But there are a lot of, you know, syndromes and diseases that are associated with the immune system gone awry. And that might be a way of looking at the brain here.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. I mean, basically, you know, we want to kind of keep things from going too far in one direction, too far in the other direction. And if we can kind of keep things regulated so that we're sort of maximally adaptive, I think that's a great state to aim for.
Now, it's totally unfair of me to ask this question, but do you have a memory? Don't tell me what it is, because I don't want to get you in trouble. Do you have a memory you'd like to erase?
I think I'm actually pretty okay for now. I've been pretty lucky in my life. I don't have too many negative memories, or the ones that I've had, hopefully I've been able to learn from, so they're good to keep around.
The happy, contented David Moorman, an assistant professor of psychological and brain sciences at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Thanks so much, David.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Hi, this is Anthony White calling from Watertown in Fort Drum, New York. One memory that I would like to erase if given the opportunity would be my days in basic training from the Army. Though it was great training and I'm proud to serve my country, being yelled at, fussed at, and cursed at on a regular basis is one memory that I would not have if I could.
A lot of great stories from you. Lockport, California says, when I worked for Walmart and stole from my employer, I was young and dumb. Don't want that haunting me anymore.
My name's Kim and I'm calling from Delray Beach, Florida. It was a bad car accident that I was driving. My son was a passenger. He was seriously injured with some permanent injuries, and it's a thought that runs through my mind on a pretty consistent basis, which really doesn't serve any purpose and probably just creates more pain.
Let's hope Kim can get over that unfortunate memory. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Catch up on that conversation. Listen back to anything on the program at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people. Created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.